And what poll's worse, inflation or recession? What if the answer is both?
Yeah, I mean, and the sad thing is, I think we're going to find out the answer to that question pretty soon. Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. Thanks for joining us for part two of our interview with economic researcher Jeffrey Snyder. If you haven't yet watched part one of this discussion with Jeff, in which he explains why the Fed is pretty much powerless at this point to prevent the economy from hurtling into recession, head over to our channel at youtube.com/Wealthion and watch it there first. It sets the context for the investment themes we discuss in this video. Jeff also shares his outlook on which assets will perform best through the rough ride he sees ahead for the rest of this year, so be sure to stick around to the end for that. Okay, let's get started watching part two of our interview with Jeffrey Snyder. Would you, from your point of view, say that the Fed is making a policy mistake here in terms of continuing to tighten into a problem that is solving itself?
Yeah, well, I think that the Fed was correct last year when they said it was transitory. And I think they actually believe that. And they would have been correct if they had believed that, because they at least understand the basic economics at work here. And I think what changed earlier this year was the politics. Now, I know the Fed's independent, all that crap. No. The Fed was given a lot of political pressure, put under a lot of political pressure, because let's face it, that's the number one issue that voters are focused on this year is consumer prices.
Yeah.
Although it's consumer prices plus recession, but by and large, you know, the politics of the situation has changed, and you saw the Fed's rhetoric change, and they've had to try to come up with a way to make themselves relevant to this political discussion, because how on earth are rate hikes going to get more oil out of the ground or get containers from the West Coast to China? They're not. This is all pretense. This is all pretend. This is all done for political show and political theater. So I think deep down, the Fed knows that rate hikes are not going to solve anything, but at least it allows the government to say, well, we've got the Fed. It's the most aggressive, and it's the Fed. You don't fight the Fed. It's the central bank. Everybody relies on it. And so it's in terms of politics, the Fed is raising rates, but on some level they understand. In fact, I know they understand, because you look at some of the models that they put out, like the FRB and Wise model, for example, the DSGE model for the U.S. economy, which shows that in all likelihood, according to this Fed model, by the time we get to the end of next year, GDP will be lower than it was at the end of last year. So the Fed models understand that something bad is going on here, and it's probably not going to be because of rate hikes, it's because of supply shock factors. And it's really the Fed, as far as making a policy error, is more about a political error than anything.
All right, so let's assume for a second here that the administration's calling the shots and saying, all right, Fed, politically, we need you to do this. If that's true, you know, it sounds like they are setting themselves up for, perhaps an even bigger crisis. They're making a trade-off for an even worse outcome, right? Where it's like, look, and I get it. Look, high inflation, that is a stone-cold election killer, right? So you're petrified of that if you're an incumbent. But by forcing the Fed to tighten here, very quickly, you might end up with too much of the opposite, which is, oh my God, we've now created a massive punishing recession, and that's a stone-cold election killer either.
That's even worse. Yeah. Who asked the question, what poll's worse, inflation or recession? The answer is both?
Yeah, I mean, the sad thing is, I think we're going to find out the answer to that question pretty soon.
And I think that's why the market has priced what it is, because the market realizes that the political pressure to raise rates quickly becomes the political pressure to unwind them very quickly if we get into a nasty recession scenario. So, when you look at the way the markets are positioned, the way things are actually taking shape, it makes a lot of sense here. And it doesn't make sense in terms of money printing. And I would add one other thing here that nobody is talking about, because nobody ever talks about this, even though it is the biggest monetary factor and the biggest monetary danger and has been over the last intervening decades. You know, if you go back to 2007 and 2008, if you asked me what was, to use a single word to describe the 2008 crisis, I would say collateral. It wasn't about subprime mortgages. It was a collateral shortfall, a collateral shortage that became essentially a repo run that essentially devastated the entire global system and global marketplace. And we've never fixed that. We've never solved that. One of the reasons why is because everybody thinks bank reserves are money. Everybody thinks the Fed printed a lot of money. Therefore, why would we worry about liquidity risks anymore? When in fact, the collateral system has been increasingly worse shape over through time. March of 2020 is a perfect example of what happens when you don't have enough collateral. The Fed didn't save anything. The Treasury Department did more than the Fed. But essentially, we have a collateral problem. And some of the collateral indications that we've seen over the last several months are alarming.
Okay, and sorry to interrupt, but can you just define really what you mean by collateral?
Collateral is financial assets that are used to secure essentially funding transactions of various nature. This is where the Eurodollar system really gets its more complicated features. A simple repurchase agreement or repo transaction sounds simple. You have cash, Adam, I have a financial security. You want to lend that cash as safe as you possibly can. So you say, well, you give me the rights to your financial security. And if you default, I get to sell your security. I get to be made whole. So I'm essentially posting a financial security for the cash that I'm borrowing from you. But as we find out in practice, it's not so simple as that, because most of the times I'm going to post a security to you that I don't even own. It's owned by somebody else. It's been reused and repledged a million times over. And so it's not, repurchase agreements aren't always cash for collateral. There are many that are collateral for collateral. For example, I might be a hedge fund. I want to invest in junk bonds because I think they offer the best returns in this environment. But I also want to fund these junk bonds as cheaply as I can. So I'll contact a dealer and say, I want to go in the repo market to fund these junk bonds that I want to own. But if I go into the repo market with these junk bonds, they're going to give me a huge haircut, which means I have to put up a lot of my own money to buy them. I don't want to do that. I want to borrow a U.S. Treasury from you so that I can take that U.S. Treasury into the repo market and get the best possible term. They get a low rate, get a low haircut. I can have the most leverage possible. So I'm borrowing a Treasury from a dealer that I then pledge into the repo market to borrow the cash that I can then use for junk bonds. And then the junk bonds I buy, I'm going to use as collateral for the collateral that I borrowed from the dealer. But as it turns out, the dealer, that the treasury I got from the dealer isn't really the dealer's either. They've got it from somebody else. So we have these multiple collateral legs that get really complicated, really screwed up. They cross boundaries. There's lots of junk. There's lots of not junk. There's lots of these collateral for collateral transactions. Long story short, when we started to get into these periods where these junk collateral that's at sort of at the end of these collateral chains becomes reevaluated for various reasons, like subprime mortgages in 2006 and 2007, that's what really happened, was that it kicked off a collateral implosion because of reevaluating the valuations and haircuts in some of the repo transactions. And in 2022, we have a global economy that's really sick. It's really not doing well, that is never recovered from 2020. And now the markets start to reevaluate some of that junk collateral. What ends up happening is, as the hedge fund, I've put up junk collateral for US Treasury so I can go into repo. Now the dealer says, I don't like your junk either. I need to change the haircut, or you need to put in some of your own money. Otherwise, I'm not going to let you borrow this treasury anymore. And if I can't borrow the treasury, I can't fund my portfolio in repo, which means I got to fire sale my assets. So it becomes a real big problem when these collateral chains start to implode on each other. And we see this happen in any number of ways, including something like repo fails, which is where collateral becomes so valuable that in a repo transaction, I lent you cash, I got your security. I say, you keep the cash, I want the security. So repo fails happen, that's a sign of collateral strain. T-bill prices, which are absolutely astronomical, especially at the front end, the four-week bill, which is yielding next to nothing, way below RRP, which tells you there's a huge collateral premium in the marketplace. There's a number of indications that tell us over the last several months, the collateral chains have been starting to implode, which will have enormous, if it continues, it can have enormous deflationary monetary consequences, which I have to believe is one of the things that's motivating Eurodollar futures or treasury curve to be so pessimistic as it is. Because when you have a simple supply shock recession, pair that with the deflationary monetary possibilities in a collateral breakdown situation, you go from Jay Powell ultra hawkish to Jay Powell ultra dovish in a flash.
Wow. Okay. So what you're talking about here is actually a really big potential threat, right? And yes, as I think you gave a nod to, we've been told a lot recently, oh, the financial system isn't nearly as vulnerable as it was back in 2008. All the banks are better capitalized, you know, that type of stuff. But you're basically...
That is absolutely the. I'm not talking about bank failures here. I don't think we're you know, everybody's waiting for the next Lehman Brothers. You're not going to see another Lehman Brothers. The banks are capitalized. They are themselves liquid, but that doesn't mean what everybody seems to think it means. Even if we don't have bank failures, we can still have gross illiquidity. March of 2020 is a perfect example. Nobody failed in 2020. That wasn't because of the Fed. That was because of bank balance sheets. Individual banks were fine, but the system was not.
Right. So you can have other parts of the system break besides the banks themselves.
Yeah. So you're focused on the wrong thing. And that's, you know, the repo fails over the last couple of weeks have been as much as they were in March 2020. In the week of June 22nd, it was almost half a trillion for the week in repo fails, which would have made the second worst week of March of 2020. That's this year. This is just a couple of weeks ago. You wonder why markets were so chaotic at the end of June, because liquidity, these collateral breakdowns, liquidity got sucked out of the entire financial system. And it's something that nobody pays attention to because they don't know they should pay attention to it. And even when you talk about tightening in the financial system, everybody thinks it's the Fed or it's QT or it's bank reserves. It's not. It's usually a collateral shortfall, which has nothing to do with the Fed. And in fact, it's one reason why the Fed isn't a central bank, isn't really part of this, because the Fed actually makes it worse. Because go back to the simple case of what QE actually is. QE is taking collateral away from the financial system and locking it up in the Fed's summer portfolio that can't be used. So the Fed actually makes the collateral system worse when it does QE, which is one of the reasons why QE never leads to inflation or the goals that it sets out for itself. Because in one very crucial sense, I would argue the primary sense, it's actually deflationary.
God, it's fascinating. So I'm going to start peppering you with questions here because we don't have a ton of time left, and I want to get as much in this session as possible. And then obviously, Jeff, we're going to have you back on again at some point because there's just so much rich territory here. But what's so concerning about these collateral crises that you're flagging here is that they create cascades, right? Where it's a domino effect that quickly gets out of hand, right? And so, as you said, that's what you think was at the heart of the 2008 great financial crisis. How concerned are you right now about this threat? Like on your threat level from 1 to being not at all to 10 being my hair's on fire, where are you?
I would say about 7 or 8. I mean, it's not catastrophic at this point. And you're right. The issue here is once these things start, it is like the proverbial snowball down the slippery slope, right? It's the snowball that goes down the hill. Once it gets started down the hill, once it picks up enough mass and momentum, there's no stopping it. And that's really the issue here. And I think that's what's really driving a lot of the illiquidity now, is that dealers in the market, in this money system, know this. They know that once these illiquidity, these collateral shortages really start, you got to get the hell out of the way. And so it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy in that respect, because once you start seeing all these signs of collateral's getting a little tight, we got to get out of it. And this is what really happened in September 2019, by the way. It wasn't about the treasury account or bank reserves. It was about dealers and inverse elasticity, which is things start to go bad, we need dealers to step in with their balance sheet capacities to get them back in line. When the snowball starts running down the hill, as it did in September 2019 or March of 2020, instead of dealers stepping in doing their job, they get out because they realize once that snowball goes down the hill, there's no stopping it. So get the hell out of the way of it.
Exactly.
And the Fed's not going to do anything about it. The Fed can't. They're powerless. In fact, you read some of the studies, you read some of the academic literature, they know they're powerless. They know they're... In fact, if you actually ask central bankers what they do, it's supposed to be lender of last resort. As I said, central banks are supposed to be currency elasticity. They're supposed to add elasticity to a system when it becomes inelastic. They know they can't do that. So they even call themselves something else, which is market of last resort. So the Fed didn't act as a central bank in March 2020, even by its own view and its own perspective. The Fed says, well, we were effective in that we bailed out the treasury market. We didn't add currency. We bailed out the treasury market, or we bailed out the corporate bond market, which, I mean, that's debatable and arguable. I would argue against it. But even by their own terms and their own standards, they realize once the crisis gets started, they have to come in at the end and hope they can be like a janitor and hope they can clean up enough that it gets restarted relatively quickly. And so the monetary system, the dealer system realizes that once these collateral chains start to go wrong, all you can do is just get out of the way. And so we're not at that point where dealers are like, we need to get out of the way, but you can see the strains, the creaks and the cracks everywhere else that are saying something's not right here. And that the slightest little spark now, because that's what happens in a fragile system, the slightest little crack, the slightest little crack too far, the dealers start to get out of the way and the thing just goes in the wrong direction.
Okay. All right. So if we get a conflagration from this, then sort of like it's Katie bar the door time, you know, everybody hunker in your bunker kind of deal. Well, I want to get to sort of how the people watching this video who maybe are now, you know, their eyes are pretty wide now, having just watched this video, are now saying, okay, so, you know, Jeff, what assets do you think offer better opportunities, protection, return, whatever, in this type of environment you see coming, and which ones should we avoid? I want to get to that question in just a minute. I wanted to dig deeper into this. Maybe we'll do it when we have you back on here, but let's just talk about the rough edges of the recession that you see coming. And I understand we're just talking probabilities here. Nobody has a crystal ball. But in terms of depth, length, you know, if the Fed pivots, can it take it out of recession quickly? Or you said that might even make things worse. Who knows? And where I'm really getting on with this is, you know, the people who are watching this video are regular people, right? And so I want to give them a sense of what to expect. And so, you know, one thing I've been tracking a lot is the potential for layoffs. And we're already beginning to see, you know, lots of job freezes across industry. We're actually seeing layoffs really pick up pretty quickly, some sectors like tech. How bad is it going to look and feel, do you think?
Well, yeah, you're right. We have no idea. We can't predict the future, but we can kind of get a sense of it. I always go back to the markets because the markets are, you know, if Eurodollar futures, for example, maybe not many people have heard of that market, but it's maybe the second deepest market in human history, apart from the treasury market. And the participants in that market are these global behemoths who are, you know, hedging against their trillions upon trillions of risky assets. So if they're hedging in a certain fashion, you got to pay attention to that because they have essentially all of this on the line. There's everything at stake. The entire systemic conditions is essentially at stake being hedged in Eurodollar futures. And so what I think they're telling us is that the Eurodollar futures market, therefore the monetary system, these gigantic banks that operate the Eurodollar, are saying that we're really worried here. This is not your garden variety, hey, this is 2001.com recession. There's something a lot more going on here. So in terms of probabilities, the probability is that we avoid recession is probably very small, very slim. The probability that we have a mild recession or normal recession, that's probably not the right term, but something like that, you know, something like 2001 or 91 or 1990, 91 or something like that, is probably somewhere toward the middle of the bell shape, the bell curve, the probability distribution. But there's also a hell of a lot of tail risk hedging going on here, which, I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be like 2008 bad or a repeat of 2008. It could just be something like March 2020, but plays out a little bit longer, given the economic fragility that we see around the global economy, that the combination here isn't really good. So probability-wise, you have, you know, pretty nasty recession, as well as the potential for deflationary money on top of it, not bank failures like 2008, but systemic illiquidity that gets really bad. And I think that's why it's not just, you see this not just in Eurodollar futures or the treasury market, you see it all over lots of, I mean, stocks, for example, cryptocurrencies. I mean, crypto is another one. I mean, crypto, digital currencies were supposed to be the preeminent inflation hedge. And now we have inflation or consumer prices accelerating to their highest level in 40 years. And this inflation hedge abandons you at the time of that you need it the most. The digital currency markets are telling you the deflationary risks are rising and they're very uncomfortable. They're very high already. And then you look at some of the details, the fragility in the collateral system, and that starts to make a lot of sense. So, you know, I don't really want to scare people here, but I want people to be aware of the fact that we have these very serious problems and these very serious concerns that are being priced into these huge sophisticated markets in a way that we haven't seen since 2007 and 2008. Again, I'm not saying we're going to repeat that, the Great Recession, global financial crisis, but I think the dangers are serious enough that we need to consider something more than your garden variety recession.
Okay, I'm going to put some words in your mouth, correct them if they're wrong, but sounds like what you're saying is it would be prudent for people to at least do the intellectual exercise of, hey, what would happen if my company downsized, if I got laid off, and then perhaps couldn't get a job for a prolonged period of time just because the job market was so bad. Are there steps I can be taking now to reduce my vulnerability or build up a pile of savings or whatnot? I see you nodding as I'm saying all this.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's where you need to start considering. Again, you got to make your own determinations here. Do your own homework and do your own self-evaluation, which everybody should be doing anyway. But that's one thing I want people to be aware of, that there are these cracks and creaks, these real fault lines in the monetary system and the real economy that you don't hear about anywhere, even though we've been dealing with these problems for the last 15 years. And so be aware of these things that are happening. Look at these markets and what they're telling you, or at least give the probabilities that they're giving you, and assess your own investing situation, your own personal situation, based on the risks that are being perceived as extreme and very real in these marketplaces.
All right, great. And I want to get to the market part now real quick. Folks, if you're watching, if you're an employee, meaning you work for a paycheck and you haven't done so already, go check out our layoff survival guide. It's a free resource, but it details a lot of questions you should be asking yourself right now and a lot of steps that you can take either in advance of job loss or, God forbid, you lose your job. It gives you a lot of sort of immediate steps that you should think about taking in the wake of that. Just go to Wealthion.com/layoffs, and it's available there for free. Okay, Jeff, let's now get into, okay, we've got a lot of regular investors watching this. I think you've opened their eyes to a lot of risks that maybe weren't even fully on their radars beforehand, but I think most of these viewers, given the guests we've had on this program, are still pretty skeptical of today's markets. So given the macro outlook that you have here, which has us, going into a recession, perhaps one worse than a garden variety one, inflation tipping back into disinflation, maybe even deflation at some point, a panic Fed getting involved somewhere down the road, maybe later this year. What assets do you have a favorable view of, if any, for this type of environment, and which ones would you really avoid?
Well, for your regular investors, there's any number of things that they can do. I mean, gold as a hedge kind of works out well in this kind of environment. However, you have to be careful because gold is extremely volatile, especially given its collateral nature too. It becomes collateral of last resort, which presents a lot of opportunity for downside, but usually it's temporary. But gold as a-
Right, it gets sold initially as people are forced to make margin calls and things like that because it's retained value. So you got to-
Yes.
Yeah.
So on a short run basis, you can see gold drop precipitously as it did several times in the 2008 crisis. But compared to something like stocks, gold performed exceptionally well, which was, I think it was essentially flat from 2007 until March of 2009. While the stock market fell 60%, gold was essentially kind of sideways, but it wasn't sideways. It was all over. It was a roller coaster all the way there. So gold is likely to hold its value. But if you're looking to actually make money, the Federal Reserve has done us all a tremendous favor. By hiking rates as aggressively as it has pushed up the short end of the yield curve, which has had a somewhat of an effect on the long end of the yield curve too. So now bond prices are relatively low compared to where they were just a few months ago, which means that if we do get into a nasty recession, bond prices, especially treasury prices, are going to go up. So there's an opportunity to buy duration, for example, which is longer yielding treasuries, with the caveat here that there's an enormous amount of short run risk involved because we don't know where exactly the Fed will stop or how long it'll take before it gets into rate cuts. So you do have, if you're going to look at buying bonds, long-term bonds and duration, you do have the short run price risk that bonds interest rates could go much higher from here where they are today to where they might be tomorrow. And then the market reverses. We don't know exactly where the Fed will reverse. We don't know where they'll take the pressure off the short end. We don't know where the exact best buying opportunity for the long end is. We just know that there's likely to be a very good buying opportunity in long run treasuries at some point, if we aren't already there? I mean, you think about where the 10-year yield has been over the last several weeks, for example. It was up as high as almost 3.5% just a few weeks ago. And then last week or the week before, it was down as low as under 280. So there was a pretty big downward move there, inversion. There's a good chance that we've seen the highest levels of rates already in the long run bonds. However, again, you have to be very careful, because in this transition period, you could also be subjected to a short run sell off. So long run, or at least in the intermediate term, a good place to look, safe assets like treasuries, though you got to be careful about the transition from here to there.
Okay. So gold, treasuries, I mean, it seems just in many ways sort of just be defensive at this point in time.
Yeah, there are times when it's better to preserve capital than try to make any. And this is probably one of those times where if you're not really sure about some of these things, you're not really sure about timing, duration, or whether you want to really be long treasuries, then maybe it's just better to be very defensive about everything.
Yeah. And so a word you didn't mention, but we'll just bring up here, which is just cash, which, yeah. You know, I would assume you would say, look, holding a healthy percentage of cash is probably not a bad thing to do right now. And what's interesting is, I think it's been a little bit of a false argument, but people have said, well, I want to be in cash if, you know, inflation's running at 9%. And of course you can say, well, all right, that's a real 9% loss on your cash, but that's way better than the real negative 30% you're getting in the S&P right now, or whatever, right? When you add the negative 20 plus than the real loss from inflation. So on a relative basis, it's great. And because it sounds like you expect decelerating inflation going forward, that inflation cost of holding debt is actually going to start dissipating pretty quickly.
Plus, it also positions you to take advantage if we are right and this does become another downward leg in stocks and other assets. If you're holding cash, you're going to be in position to buy when we get toward the end of this thing. So cash, yes, it's less of an opportunity cost given consumer prices if we get into a disinflationary, deflationary environment. Plus, you're already prepared to make money when the money is most in your favor.
Great. All right. Well, Jeff, I'd love to have you back on the program. I'd love to have you back on for several different discussions I've earmarked here. But certainly, if we get to the point here where there are lower prices and better values for the reasons that we've talked about here, I'd love to have you back on to share with us at that point where you see the best value for beginning to deploy capital, if that's all right.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, look, Jeff, this has been absolutely wonderful. It's been a fascinating conversation. Thanks so much for coming on. Finally, thanks so much for giving so much of your time and such a great discussion. For viewers that hadn't had a lot of exposure to you, but have really enjoyed getting to know you through this interview here, where can they go to follow you and your work?
Well, they can follow. I have a podcast I've co-hosted with Emil Kalinowski. It's called Eurodollar University. You can find it on YouTube under his channel, Emil Kalinowski at YouTube. It's on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all the usual podcast outlets. I do a lot of research material, which you can find at marketsinsiderpro.com. I've recently partnered with Steve Van Meter. We share a lot of common beliefs, common outlook, common framework for investment, as well as macro and monetary analysis. Again, that's marketsinsiderpro.com for research. If you're interested in portfolio management, it's Atlas Financial, which you can check Steve's portfolio strategies out at portfolioshield.net. And usually, I'm around on the internet. I have a regular weekly column at Real Clear Markets. I have a regular weekly column at Epic Times. I do a lot of special features and presentations too. So if you Google my name, you're probably going to find it somewhere.
Great. You've got a good Twitter University feed too.
Yeah. And our main website is eurodollar.university, where you can pretty much find everything that you're looking for as far as if you're looking for stuff from me.
Okay, great. And I follow you on Twitter. You've got a good Twitter account. Yes. Do you mind sharing your Twitter handle?
It's Jeff Snyder_AIP.
All right, great, Jeff. So when we edit this, we will put up links to your handle and the URLs that you mentioned there so people can find you directly. Jeff, it's been, again, a total pleasure. Really look forward to having you back on again soon. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Adam, for having me. Looking forward to it.
All right, and now's the time on the program where we bring in the lead partners of New Harbor Financial. That's one of the endorsed financial advisory firms by Wealthion to help us react to what Jeff just said, but also talk about what's going on in the markets right now. And there was a lot going on in the markets right now. But Mike Preston, you're joining us today. John Lodra has the day off. Your mind, I'm guessing, is a little blown as mine was from this conversation with Jeff. So curious to get your feedback here.
Yeah, you know, that was a very deep conversation. I mean, there was a lot of data in there, a lot. And I'll do my best to distill it, or at least parts of it down that were really the most meaningful to me. There's a lot of talk about the Fed in there. Like most of our conversations these days, we talk about the Fed because the Fed is really the elephant in the room. The Fed is the one pushing all the levers. They are in control. They've been in control for a very long time, certainly for the last 12 years. And it's unfortunate because we really should be discussing market trends and technicals and fundamentals and cash flows and earnings estimates. But really, most of us are reduced these days of talking about the Fed. What are they going to do? Are they going to pivot? Are they going to reverse course? Are they going to cut rates? Ultimately, we think that the markets are primed from a statistical standpoint to fail in some way, to create some kind of economic crisis in the future that's going to be difficult for all of us. And I think that we're going to be able to blame that on the Fed. Sadly, this has gone on longer than I would have thought it would. And furthermore, I think it's going to take some pain before anything's going to change. So Jeff talks about a few different things. He says it's pretty clear that inflation is here, at least for now. And, you know, we saw a CPI print this morning. I don't remember the exact number, but it was over 9%. It's front and center. Prices for everything are going up. Says furthermore that we're almost certainly in a global recession or entering a global recession, if not already in it. And this one's likely to be more strong than your garden variety recession, I think he said. We couldn't agree more. I mean, we were just talking about the yield curve earlier, you and me, and the yield curve is inverted. Maybe we'll talk about more of that later, but it's a sure sign or close to a sure sign that we're likely in a recession. So, and the Fed is all about psychology. Their other tools are not that effective. All they have is psychology. You know, and Jeff says that they're manipulative in a way. Their tactics are manipulative. I've often said that to me, it seems like some kind of psychological game or even psychological warfare. The Fed needs us to buy things, to bid up assets, because without high prices, you really can't service the mountain of debt that we're living through. And I like that he said that the Fed really, you know, the Fed, the fact or the thought that they're all powerful is somewhat of a myth. Like I think he said, the man behind the curtain, like in The Wizard of Oz. I for one, would like to see that to come to light to everybody so that they realize that the Fed has controlled things to an extent that they really shouldn't have. If you look at valuations in any number of different ways that are statistically reliable, we're far beyond any extreme we've ever seen before and are likely to have some significant downside in the market in the years ahead. I'll pause there before we go into his recommendations for investments, but we agree with those as well, and we'll give a little more flavor later.
All right. Yeah. Well, we'll go pretty much straight into their recommendations, Jeff's recommendations, Mike, because they're so aligned with what you guys are doing at New Harbor. As soon as he was saying those, it was like, wow, Mike is really going to love this. one thing that that the Fed does that I do believe has real impact is in raising the cost of capital, right? And we've talked about this in previous videos, Mike, where we have an economy that runs on credit. And as that credit becomes more expensive, it slows the gears of commerce. And that's the way the Fed sort of helps destroy demand, which is what Jerome Powell has said he's all about these days. And we're already beginning to see that. You know, mortgage rates have doubled pretty much in the past year. Now, not all of that is the Fed's doing, but certainly the Fed is influencing that. We're seeing consumer spending beginning to slow. So, you know, the Fed essentially is hiking into what's looking increasingly like a recession here. And so, when people talk about the Fed being behind the curve and making policy mistakes, this seems like the Fed is engaged in potentially what will be declared as a big policy mistake later, because we have a very fast slowing economy. We've got the odds of recession spiking up here. Jeff, you know, himself said he thinks that that the best case scenario we can hope for here is a you know, shallow and short recession, but he thinks that the odds for that aren't very good, that it's likely to be something, you know, more painful than that. And what I'm kind of building up to here is just today, the June CPI numbers came out, right? And they came in at what, Mike? I think 9.1%.
I believe that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So 9.1. So that's even higher than last year, last month's 8.55%. Look, you know, I and many others, I think Jeff included, are expecting disinflation to start taking over at some point here, which means that the CPI rate is going to start coming down, but we're clearly not there yet. And so with a CPI, a reported CPI of 9.1%, the Fed cannot pivot at this moment in time, which is what, you know, so many analysts are expecting the Fed to do, and so many investors waiting on the sidelines with dry capital are waiting for. I think the Fed is going to have to continue, you know, at least continue hiking along the program that it's previously announced, but probably up it. And I was just watching this morning, there had been debate up until yesterday of a 50 basis points to 75 basis points high at the Fed's meeting later this month. Now it's the discussions between a 75 basis point to 100 basis point hike. As of this morning, the 100 point basis point hike was actually had the leading odds. It's a little bit of a horse race between the two right now. But where I'm going with this is that sand in the gears, that slowing of the economy is only going to get more extreme here in the near term as the Fed continues to have to hike more aggressively here in the face of such hot inflation. And, you know, we've already seen the GDP numbers for Q1 and Q2 come in negative. The Q2 numbers are tentative at this point in time, but let's assume they stick there for a second. We could see continued economic deceleration going into the rest of the year. Of course, that could mean continued lower asset prices. We're seeing the housing market cool and roll over really substantially here. And as I've been banging about a lot in this program, the risk of recession of layoffs triggered by a recession just seems to grow by the minute here. And so, you know, where I'm going with all this is the Fed may be putting its brakes on the economy, but at the same time, it's kind of putting its foot on the accelerator in terms of our progress towards a more painful recession. And I think, you know, what we've just seen today with the higher CPI is only going to accelerate that. So I'll take a pause here, Mike, to let you react to this. But, you know, it's no surprise to me that Jeff is saying that's why this is a time to be defensive. That's why he listed those very defensive plays that you guys are currently invested in.
Yeah, I mean, everyone talks about the Fed's policy mistake. I hope that, you know, they make a mistake that causes this kind of equilibrium moment, this moment of justice that brings things back to earth, because their real mistake is not hiking rates into a recession. Their real mistake is doing what they've done for the last two decades, particularly the last 12 or 14 years. There's no reason for the Fed to have, you know, created base money or have money on their balance sheet of something equal to 40% of gross domestic product, something like $10 trillion on the balance sheet. And our GDP countrywide is low, 22 trillion, something like that. It's a massive, massive creation, you know, of money, base money. And, you know, they just went way, way, way too far. And like you said, there's, you know, sand in the gears now. And because of political pressure really is why they're, I think they have to hike. And I think that Jeff said this too, they have to get inflation down and maybe it'll crash the markets. Maybe that would be a good thing. I hate to say that because I know a lot of people will feel psychological pain from that. But, you know, frankly, it's, I think that's completely and totally the culpability or the fault of the Fed. So yeah, we think that you should be in cash and in basically miners and bullion. And we even have a trade on in long-term bonds. And, you know, Jeff talked about that too. If we have a strong recession / depression, bonds should go up in price. Rates should come back down. We agree completely. Don't really want to be in long-term bonds for the long term, but in the short term, I think it probably makes sense. So to me, this market looks like it's topping or topped, frankly, it topped back in November of last year. If you look at the Wilshire 5000, it's been a very, very orderly decline. Been no panic whatsoever. And we've been bouncing around now in a few hundred point range on the S&P. To me, it looks like we're about ready to have some sort of elevator drop, maybe to a range of 3,200 to 3,500, to use a broad range. We wouldn't really get too interested until we get down towards that area and starting to add exposure. And even then, we'd be very hedged because of the fact that this market is very overvalued even there. It's hard to really describe just how extreme this time is that we've been living through these last few years and 10 years. And I think we're about to find out the price of that in the coming months and year.
All right. Well, yeah, there's so many potential shoes to drop based upon what you just said there, Mike, which is that we've had an unsustainable system. And as the chickens begin to come home to roost, there's, you know, an awful lot of, you know, continued downward surprises that could happen as those chickens come home. One big chicken that could come home in the very near term is earnings forecasts downgrades that we are likely to hear coming up in just the next couple of weeks as companies begin to announce their Q2 earnings. Jeff and I talked about this. We won't have to wait very long to see what the impact of those are going to be. All right. So a couple of things about sort of Jeff's list and pretty much how you guys are positioned right now, which is heavy cash, long duration U.S. treasuries and gold, and in your guys' case, the miners. Let me start with that one first. If you guys watching are interested in hearing kind of the latest, the latest argument for better days ahead for precious metals and other commodities, I just published a video this morning, which was a webinar that I moderated this week between Rick Rule and Brian London, who are two very longtime, highly respected and very experienced natural resource stock investors. And believe it or not, despite the current washout that's gone on in that space, they are getting incredibly bullish about the prospects for the sector. Yes, it could go lower as we enter a recession here, but Rick especially, who's been investing for over 50 years in this sector, has said this looks very much like several movies he's seen before over the course of his career. And they're ones where you want to be early much more than even a little bit late to. So if you want to hear that argument, I'll put a link up to the video here. Secondly, on long duration treasuries, it's a crazy time in the treasury markets right now. And by that, I mean, finally, as we've mentioned in a few of these videos before, Mike, the situation used to be TINA, which was, hey, that's why you have to be in the stock market, is because you can't get a return through other assets. Well, now the bond market's beginning to offer a notable return. And that changes the game a bit for investors at this point, especially for those that are sitting on, you know, hard losses in stocks, S&P down 20%, NASDAQ down closer to 30, the average stock in both indices down more than the indices themselves. You've got that going on, but then also you've got the specter of recession that we talked about. And during recessionary times, when markets really get pummeled, money tends to flow into, you know, at least treasuries as a safe trade. And you and I, right before we hopped on here, we were looking at the current inversion in the yield curve for U.S. treasuries, and both were pretty surprised to see that the one-year U.S. treasury is now yielding more than the 10-year or the 30-year U.S. treasury. So, Mike, if I took notes correctly, and feel free to correct me, as of the time of this recording, the one-year U.S. treasury is yielding a 3.12% return, the 10-year is yielding a 2.9%, and the 30-year is yielding a 3.06% return. So if you care about safety, you know, do you want to be buying a 30-year bond right now at a lower yield, or do you want to just put your money in a bunch of one-year treasuries where you know you're going to get your principal back soon and you're going to get an attractive rate of return on that? So, Mike, how significant is this? Because you live in the space, you've followed the markets for decades. How significant is the fact that the one-year is trading higher than both the 10 and the 30 right now?
It's very significant. I mean, it's a huge indicator of a recession. You know, it's not perfect like any indicator, but it's very significant to see this type of inversion. I mean, we had to live through 10 years of near zero interest rates post-financial crisis, 2008, 2009. And frankly, leading up to that housing crisis, even before that time, interest rates were cut after the tech crash. So it's been a long, long era of rates being cut. And for the first time in over a decade, you can get 3% on a one-year note. It's, to me, I wonder why anyone would take risk or much risk at all in an S&P 500 that has still hyper-elevated valuations and all kinds of downside risk when you can get a risk-free return of 3% for 1 year.
Right. And sorry to interrupt, Mike, but let me just add the data point that I think the average dividend yield on the S&P right now is below 2%.
Yeah.
So to your point, you could be in an equity market that's already down 20%+ this year, right? So its relative performance is underperforming treasury bonds and it's yielding less, right? It's like the worst of both worlds.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. And I don't know why people are still in. Why is the passive crowd still in? I can only say that it's slow to wake up because the decline has been very, very orderly. 2021 was an extreme year, almost grotesque in the amount and the number of bubbles that you saw, all one after another. Stocks, housing, crypto, meme stocks, SPACs. I mean, it's just one after another. And then the market topped, like I said, in November or January of this year, depending upon which index you look at. And it's been very orderly with no panic thus far. So, you know, I just think there's so many signs out there. I mean, there was all kinds of euphoria for the last few years, particularly culminating with last year. And we have a yield curve inversion again, and there is an alternative. You know, like I said earlier, why would you put your money in a market that you really believe statistically will offer zero returns over the next decade or more when you can get 3% guaranteed right now? I know there's a counter argument about inflation, which printed 9.1, but just remember that's an instantaneous reading. And it's very possible, maybe even likely, as asset prices drop, which they should, though we can't guarantee, that we'll see price cuts and we'll actually see inflation come down, could even see deflation in the next kind of market crisis. So we're very heavy in cash equivalents, i.e. short-term bonds. In fact, just a tad over 50% at the moment with almost no net stock market exposure. And I talk to people all the time. I talked to a couple today that had some money and they were thinking maybe they'd want to buy a house in the next year or two if the market came down. And they were wondering if they should put if the housing market came down, they were wondering if they should put their money in the stock market now that it's pulled back a little. Like I told them, no, why even bother? For a lot of people, just park the money in a 1 year or a 2 year bond, particularly if you know you're going to have a need for that money in the next year or so. You can always sell the bond early. You could have a small loss or a small gain, but my bet would be it would be a gain, just in my estimation, particularly if we're right about the recession and the stock market coming down. So now more than ever, you're actually getting paid something to wait. And I think it makes some sense to do that. But at the same time, there's some other values, like I said, and we're managing those values like gold stocks and long-term bonds, and even emerging markets look increasingly attractive here.
Okay. Well said, Mike. Look, you mentioned about a minute or two ago, sort of statistically, the stock market is expected to yield a negative return for the next decade. I'm just going to put up a chart here because I know you were referencing probably the work from John Hussman.
Absolutely.
So we'll put up the latest version of his chart where he shows how he calculates that. All right. And then, you raised the question, you're not sure why the descent has been orderly so far and people are still willing to hang in equities at this point, given, you know, the issues you just raised there. And I would say a big part of the answer probably goes back to what you said earlier, which is I would lay the blame at the foot of the Fed, which is it is just trained investors for the past 10, 20 years to be long, to just be mindlessly long. Right. Always buy the dip, always hang into the market because the Fed with the Fed put and all of its rescues it's done over the years. It's just told people, don't worry, we got your back. And the danger of doing that, of training the investing public to do that, is that if you end up changing, your stance, which the Fed may have done here, you've just prepared people to basically just, you know, walk off the cliff because they're assuming you're going to save them, but you're not necessarily there to do so. So
Yeah. So again,
it's a definition of a bubble, isn't it? Oh, sorry, Adam. I mean, everyone can see it. It's kind of clear, but you don't really believe it can be dangerous this time.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, it's how their muscles have been developed. They don't really have a reverse at this point in time. All right. So just one more reason to lay culpability here at the feet of the Fed. All right. And then to your point there about, I don't understand why somebody, especially if they've got relatively short-term goals of using money for something else, why they just don't park it in a short-term U.S. Treasury. So I put out a video last week, which I'll put up a link to here, on I-bonds. Look, there's pros and cons to them. This isn't necessarily a commercial for them, but just to flag for folks, you know, I-bonds right now are yielding over 9%. They're really one of the only assets out there that is yielding a positive real return right now, that's yielding more than the current 9.1 CPI measured inflation rate. I think the latest I-bond return is something like 9.62%. It's not going to be that way forever, but certainly as inflation keeps going up and remaining hot, that number is just going to adjust even higher. So, you know, and that is a very safe bond. You will get your principal back whenever you want, when you want to sell that bond. There are some trade-offs if you sell a little bit too early, but honestly, they're relatively minor. But you know, there are some amazing opportunities that haven't been amazing like this for a long, long time out there right now. I did also promise in that video, I'd do a video on tips. I've been trying to get that done this week. It got a little sidetracked by having to do that webinar with Brian and Rick. So we opted to film that first. But the tips video will be coming out next week, and that stands for Treasury Inflation Protected Securities. So folks, I will be delivering on that promise. But I will tell you too, in environments like this, it may be better to just own treasuries than owning I-bonds or tips. And the reasons why can be a little bit nuanced, but, and Mike, I'd love for you to chime in on this, but if we tip into a big global recession here that sends sort of, you know, financial shockwaves across the world, and or if the Fed pivots, both of those are scenarios where we could see a lot of capital flooding into the long end of the U.S. Treasury bond, pushing rates down, on the 30-year Treasury, say, which would push its price up pretty substantially. Right. So it gets a little bit, you know, complicated as you sort of try to figure out the math that can happen in different situations with bonds. But what I want to sort of flag for folks here is, in a high inflationary environment like this, there are advantages that these inflation protected securities offer, and there's good reasons to consider them. But also there are some, you know, sort of related events, sort of second derivative events that if they occur, they actually can make the return of a long-dated U.S. Treasury pretty appealing. So, Mike, what do you think about here?
Well, we have a position, a trading position in the long-term bond. And let me just use TLT as an example. You know, it is the most popular exchange-traded fund that owns U.S. Treasury bonds that are greater than 20 years in duration. And frankly, we think it's a pretty good short-term trade. I'm not sure that I'm willing to commit to long-term bonds for a long period. I may be wrong on that. But to me, just looking at the technicals and the fact that yields overshot to the upside and bond prices to the downside, I like long-term bonds, regular long-term bonds for a trade here, maybe 3 to 6 months. You know, TLT is trading at around, I think, 116 or so. To me, it looks like it can go to 125 easy and probably higher and maybe much higher if we have a strong recession and inflation abates and we start to get some deflationary even kind of signals. Then bonds, long-term bonds, can go a lot higher. When I'm looking at yields here, you're right. The one-year yield is 3.12%. The 30-year bond is 3.06, lower than the 1 year. So why would you buy a 1 year bond versus just buying a 30-year bond? Well, to me, the short-term bond is for that money that you have in cash. Maybe you sold a house or a business, or maybe you pulled money out of the stock market. What do you do with it? Put it into a short-term bond. Don't worry about gyrations and inflation and deflation, things like that. It's okay just to to walk away. Don't play the game. Get out of the market with some or even all of your money if that's what you want to do. Park it in a shorter term bond. Don't worry about anything else. From a trading perspective, I think that a long-term bond is going to perform better over the next 6 months. So, and I think you asked me, why would you buy a one-year bond at 3%? Or why would you buy a 30-year bond at 3% when you could buy a one-year bond at 3%? The real reason is that you can make a big capital gain on the long-term bond if we have deflationary or recessionary forces. So, and I-bonds can negate some of that risk. If you're right about long-term inflation, I-bonds can give you an adjustment to make that feel better and give you better performance. But if we have true deflationary pressures, you know, my opinion that would be that the regular bonds would do better because they're guaranteed that they don't have a negative adjustment.
Right. And that's what I was sort of trying to flag here for folks, which is, and we should probably have an open Q&A with the audience on this at some point in time. Folks, if you're interested in that, let me know in the comment section below here, because we're at this really, I keep using the word treacherous to describe this year's investing climate. The thing is you can't really have a ton of confidence in any particular trend in terms of how long it's going to run for, right? So right now, the world is completely and understandably freaked out about inflation. And of course, we just had an even higher inflation print this morning. And of course, that makes a good argument for owning a lot of these inflation protected securities. But you have to understand, as Mike is saying here, how they perform if inflation peaks and then starts abating, right? Because that does have an impact on the pricing of these securities, and each security has a different reaction to this, right? And as you said, Mike, you know, the US Treasury, there are particular outcomes here where it could deliver really good capital appreciation, even if it's delivering sort of lower, interest payments along the way than the shorter term bond would, right? So as an investment, that could be an attractive part of portfolio. Now, of course, other outcomes could happen that could make treasuries go down a lot further in price, right? So you got to be really careful here, sort of what I'm understanding. There's just what I'm trying to underscore here is there's a lot of different factors in play here, but probably net-net, what's interesting here is there's just a lot of securities that really weren't very appealing or of interest to investors for the past decade that are now sort of suddenly coming back to life here, which provides opportunity. But again, you know, I guess the way I'll put a bow around all this is, you know, but it's complicated. And this is where I think you really want to partner with a professional financial advisor who can really help you look at all the different options that are out there. And then to your point, Mike, say, well, what are your goals, right? If you need this money within a year or two for a different purchase or whatever, well, then let's take this path here. But if this money is going to ride for the next, you know, 5, 10, 15 years, let's allocate it this way so that we can, you know, have some opening to some of these high potential outcomes that we're talking about here. So Mike, why don't we start wrapping it up here with that? What kind of parting advice would you have for folks around that point?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, the traditional financial advice is kind of what I just said, you know, to have for short-term money, have it in a real safe place, long-term money maybe allocated differently. Interestingly, the opportunities have kind of flattened out a little bit. And, you know, we have retreated to mostly short-term cash because valuations and extremes have just gotten so severe in the market, particularly in the last couple of years, that all returns have been compressed down to zero or less is what you could expect. So there's really not much you should do, in our opinion anyway, right now, other than to have full-on defense, lots of cash, a core position in real things like gold and silver, and miners and emerging markets, which essentially is what is in our portfolio right now. And then you could be tactical on severe declines or even moderate declines in the market in certain sectors or even in the broad market. But, you know, for most people, it's just, you really should just be playing broad, full-on defense right here, because you're not missing anything. I guess that's what I'm trying to say here. You're not missing much opportunity by being defensive. As expected returns on almost everything is near zero. So right. We're going to have to see that dislocation.
All right. So we'll pull back the old
picking up nickels in front of the steamroller analogy here, which is just, I hear you're saying, look, stretching for, you know, return here right now, it just isn't worth the risk. It's just better to just get yourself to safety, wait for this, the investing situation to improve, and then deploy your capital then, hopefully at much better valuations. I see.
I believe so. The hardest thing to do though, but I believe so.
Okay, great. All right. Well, look, I want to underscore in wrapping up here, your point there about playing defense. I think you should do that financially, folks. I also think that you should be doing that in other aspects of your life, given the current environment. I am personally, I've been warning a lot on this program through my own social media channels about the rising risk of recession and the potential for layoffs that could come along with that. The 9.1% CPI print this morning, I think, ramps up both the odds for recession and the odds for layoffs. And the reason for that is hot inflation compresses profit margins at companies. It also forces consumers to spend less. That's going to exacerbate the situation. So companies are going to struggle more just profitability-wise from their operations. They're also going to struggle more because the cost of capital is going up, because the Fed, like I said, is going to have to be more aggressive with rate hikes from here, which is going to compress profitability financially for companies. And so it's just math, you know, honestly, folks, that just ends up in companies being able to afford to employ fewer workers. So I'm just telling folks, just, you know, look at your employment situation, ask yourself, how vulnerable am I to a layoff if my company, you know, enters tough times? If it does, what are my options? What would I do if I got laid off? If you haven't already, folks, go read our free resource. It's our layoff survival guide. There's a bunch of tips to do now before potentially your company gets into layoff territory. And then there's a lot of tips for what happens if you actually get that pink slip. So to read that, just go to Wealthion.com/layoffs. But most importantly, folks, just start battening down the hatches, you know, in your planning, because it looks like we are seeing increasing onshore winds from what, you know, looks like Jamie Dimon's predicted economic hurricane. So on that cheery note, Mike, we'll start to wrap things up here. A reminder to folks, you know, main reason we do these videos is to help you become better informed so that you can make more prudent decisions in your life about protecting and growing your wealth. We remain convinced that for the vast majority of people, a key success strategy for that is working with a financial advisor that understands the macro risks that Jeff and I talked about and that Mike and I have been talking about here. If you've got a good one, fantastic, stick with them. Send them this video and say, hey, watch it, and then give me a call and tell me how I'm well positioned for these factors that Jeff was talking about. If you don't have a good one, or you'd like a second opinion from one that does understand all these issues, fill out the short form at Wealthion.com and we'll connect you with one of our endorsed financial advisors. We'll connect you with Mike and his team at New Harbor if that's what you want. With that said, folks, prioritize safety going forward from here. Thanks so much for watching, everybody. Mike, thank you for yet another week of great analysis and insight. And look, as you said, nobody knows what's going to happen next in these markets, but you and I and your partner, John, there will be tracking it every week, including next week on this channel, helping to make sense of it for folks. Thanks for your time, Mike. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.
Thank you, Adam. I really enjoyed it this week, and I'll see you soon.
If you'd like to schedule a consultation with one of the financial advisors at New Harbor Financial, simply go to Wealthion.com. These consultations are completely free, and there are no strings attached. The good folks at New Harbor will simply answer any questions you have about your investment goals or your portfolio and give you their best advice given their latest market outlook. They're willing to do this because they care about protecting people's wealth, and because Wealthion has connected them with so many thoughtful investors just like you over the past decade. We started doing this because so many people have approached us in frustration, looking for a solution because they're feeling out of alignment or downright ridiculed by the standard financial advisors who have been managing their money. You know the type. The kind that just pushes all of your money into the market, scoffs at the idea of owning gold, and when you bring up concerns about the market's sky-high valuations, they say, "Don't worry, the market will always take care of you." For many of the reasons discussed in today's video, we think this is one of the most challenging and treacherous times in history for investing. We strongly believe that today's investors are best served working in partnership with a conscientious professional financial advisor who understands the risks in play. Now, we're agnostic which professional advisor you work with, as long as they're good. If you're already working with one, that's fantastic. Stick with them. But if you don't, or are having trouble finding one you respect or trust, then consider talking to John and Mike and the team at New Harbor. Now, for those about to ask, yes, there's a business relationship between Wealthion and New Harbor, which we've put in place to make sure everything is handled according to SEC regulations. All the details on this are clearly provided on the Wealthion.com website. Also, it's important to note that New Harbor is able to work with U.S. citizens, green card holders, and those with existing assets in the USA. But for regulatory reasons, they aren't able to take on non-U.S. clients. All right, with all that said, if you'd like some insight and guidance on how to protect your wealth during this unprecedented time in the markets, go to Wealthion.com to schedule your free consultation with the good folks at New Harbor. Thanks for watching.